Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this Tuesday. Usually Tuesday is 2 hours of open forum, and so we decided today we'll do 2 hours of open forum, just like we usually do. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Second hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be our guest. And first hour, Trent Horn's back. That's good news. Trent, of course, apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a bunch of books, the order of which I got wrong yesterday. But now I know, and now I've been corrected. Hi, Trent.
Hello, Cy.
888-318-7884, the number. Trent loves apologetics questions. If you got an apologetics question, I mean, yesterday we did tips for defending the faith. Pretty much there was a whole bunch of calls that we weren't even able to get to. There's so many people who wanted to ask those questions. So if you got that kind of question, you're very welcome. 888-318-7884. But you don't have to be Catholic. You know, you could be just a Christian person or a person who believes in God and you'd like a defense of Jesus or a way to help people, other people come to a belief in God. 888-318-7884. How's the book coming, the new book, Trent?
It's on its way, Cy. I have been working on a new book on a dialogue with my inner skeptic.
I thought the next book was Things the Saints Never Did.
I brought that up yesterday on the show, wondering, you know, if people would want a book like that. And I would be interested to see if people would like a book that dealt with the stories of the saints, talking about each saint, like the stories we love that they probably didn't do that are not that historically accurate.
Yeah.
And then the things they did do that we have decent historical accounts of.
Right.
A lot of people did not like their bubbles burst when I told them that most of the things we love St. Francis for saying he never actually said. So then in the next book, when I'm right, oh, when you love this account of what St. Francis did, like, oh, that probably didn't happen, but this probably happened. You never know.
Yeah. Like I know. I guess everyone knows now the famous St. Francis one that we've all said, but Francis didn't say it. But did he say, make me a channel of your peace?
Oh, no, that is from that's from a song, the saints. That's the Saint Francis prayer, yeah. And that was immortalized more in a song in the 1960s. But no, Saint Francis's prayers were typically focused on God. They're very Christocentric, not anthropocentric. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare in the prayers of Saint Francis where you see him say, "Lord, help me do this, so I may do that." They're focused more on God and on Jesus than they are on ourselves.
Another one down. Another one down. Trent Horn's our guest, 888-318-7884. If you got a question, your questions are welcome here. 888-318-7884. Open forum means open to anyone of any faith background. Trent started his career as a defender. Defending life is a pro-life defender, so maybe you've got a question about defending life in all of its stages. Now is a full-fledged defender of the faith, and that has many different levels. So again, if you're not a Catholic or even a Christian, but you're a believer in God and you'd like help how to convince others to believe in God, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Maybe you need a defense of Jesus or of the historicity of the Gospels. That's a very fancy word, historicity. I always feel very professorial when I use it. And I also feel professorial when I use the word professorial.
So professorial.
I'm having a good day.
It's erudite, and it's another good word in that lineup would be edifying. Instead of saying something's helpful, you would say, I hope this has been edifying to you, to build you up into an edifice.
It's funny because around here, the word that I hear more is disedifying, because Chris Check, our president, is constantly advising us, let's not be disedifying. Like, for example, people will pick fights with us here at Catholic Answers. You know, the Catholic Answers people said this, and they're so, and then you want to respond, and Chris will say, let's not be disedifying to people.
I'm gonna check this right now. Is
disedifying
a word?
Yeah, disedifying. Like instead of
disedifying.
Yeah, and instead of edifying people, you disedify them when you.
I don't know if it's a word.
It is a word. All right, fine. I'm looking it up.
I bet you it's a very impactful word.
I'm not even going to listen to your answer to the next question.
Chat, people on social media. I'm looking it up right now. I have never heard of the word disedify, and it's not popping up immediately. I don't think it's a word.
All right. It's a word.
Did he mean maybe it's unedify?
No.
Oh, yeah. Unedifying.
Disedify is a word. It's in the Merriam.
No, it says it's unedifying.
It's
because
no,
edifying
disedify
is
means
verb.
To fail to edify. Unedifying is something. It's a modifier of a noun. So it's an unedifying event or to disedify is an action to make someone fail to be edified, to scandalize them, to injure them. I know this. I'm gonna look it up and I'm gonna get it for you. And I'm not even gonna listen to your first answer to a question.
Okay, wait. I see it here. Well, I guess it's here in Merriam-Webster. I think you're right.
Plus, Chris Check has read more books than almost anybody I know. Like, if you just say a book, he'll go, oh, yeah, and then he'll tell you what he didn't like about it. He knows if disedify is not a word. You need to – propinquity is also a word. That's another Chris Check
word. You know what,
Sai?
It is a word, and you know what you have done right now for me? You have edified me.
I have edified you by giving you – putting disedify in your vocabulary. I'm going to Virginia now to talk to Joe. As much as I've enjoyed talking with you, I want you to talk with Joe now, and I'm going to go search around for every use of the word disedify on the internet. Joe, thank you for your call. I'm sure it will be very edifying. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, Trent. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of yours, Trent. Been listening to you for a while. So I just watched your debate with Matt Dillahunty. I watch all the debates with every, you know, all the apologists and the atheists, and I watch Matt Dillahunty a lot. And I just thought you did a good job of bringing it to him, because a lot of the apologists are kind of, you know, they let him get away with a lot of stuff, and I think you did a real good job.
Well, Matt Dillahunty, if you saw the debate on last Thursday on Pints of Aquinas, Matt has a reputation for, and he himself, I think, will admit, that he has a bit of an assertive and sometimes abrasive manner of confronting people he disagrees with. And that was something I was hoping wouldn't come up in the debate, but was ready for if that's the attitude he wanted to have. But yeah, we discussed the resurrection, and I thought it was an interesting debate. You can check it out on Pints with Aquinas, but I'll also air it on my podcast with a debrief probably in about a week. But yeah, so Joe, what can I help you with?
Well, I kind of want to discuss what I think what atheism, like what kind of Matt represents, kind of online as opposed with atheism. It's more of an anti-theism these days, I believe. Like, I think people just don't want God to exist or the resurrection to be true, so that you know if there's no God, then you know essentially you can live as you please. So to me, it's more of a desire these days, hoping God doesn't exist, as opposed to just the evidential problem.
Yeah, I think, Joe, I mean, there's Matt Dillahunty, who's been the host of the Atheist Experience for many years now, he does represent a particular brand of online internet atheism. It's kind of the successor of the Richard Dawkins New Atheism from 2000, in the early 2000s. It carries a lot of those similarities in that it does not treat religion, it treats religion as primarily a negative thing to reject. It can it treats it as something to attack rather than dialogue with. And I think Matt would probably say, well, I have dialogues with theists all the time. But I find in that particular approach, like the Matt Dillahunty approach to religion, similar to the Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens approach, that it's very big on rhetoric, on refuting Christianity through clever rhetoric and abrasive descriptions of things, rather than through trying to assess what Christians believe in the most charitable way possible. So Matt will frequently summarize the Christian faith in ways that distort Christian doctrine, or like in my debate, he cited Jesus's cursing of the fig tree as evidence against his divinity, without ever seriously considering what the purpose of that incident was in the Gospels and what the meaning is behind it, which is very clear in any commentary that you would read. So it's disheartening to see that his argument against the resurrection was basically an assertion that human testimony cannot tell me a miracle happened in the past, but without any kind of defense of that principle. It's just kind of a boldly made assertion instead of a carefully crafted argument, and one that leads to really a historical agnosticism, because as I showed in the debate, Matt Dillahunty didn't even say, I asked him, is it reasonable to believe Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate? And he said he didn't know, or he said it's not reasonable, which is something all scholars at every major university in the world affirm. So it's unfortunate, and it's kind of almost anti-intellectualism sometimes. But thank you, though, Joe, for calling in on that. And I'd recommend others, if you want to check out that debate, go to the Pints of Aquinas YouTube channel, and you can watch it for yourself there.
Thanks. Our number 888-318-7884. If you've got a question for Trent Horn, about to go to a break, but I went over to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and I looked up.
Really?
I looked up disedify. And at the bottom, after they give you all the definitions, it says, what made you want to look up disedify? And then people put their comments of what made them look it up. And I wrote, Trent Horn said it's not a word. So now that's on the Merriam-Webster Dictionary webpage. Trent Horn said it's not a word.
I am famous now. I am in the dictionary.
I've always
wanted to get there.
Yeah, you can go look it up. Just look up disedify on the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and they'll say, Trent Horn said it's not a word. 20 Answers Summer Reading Challenge. Everyone knows how I feel about calling it the Summer Reading Challenge, so I'm not going to go into my feelings about this again. But we are offering 70% off when you buy the full 44 books in the Catholic Answers 20 Answers series. 70% off, that's pretty good. You get all 44 books, and then you can read them through the summer. It's like a summer reading challenge. We're starting early. Give you a head start. Just go to shop.catholic.com and get your 70% off all 44 books in the 20 Answers series.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The world over with Rima DeRoyo. Coverage as seen through a Catholic lens.
All people of faith and sincerity need to awaken to this and protect this fundamental right of religious liberty.
Expert analysis.
Does revelation judge history, or does history judge revelation?
Stories vital to people of faith.
It's part of our faith that comedy and tragedy naturally go hand in hand.
Delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up today. Go to ewtn.com/worldover.
A particularly edifying couple of hours today. Second hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here. This hour, Trent Horn. You're welcome to ask any question you'd like on Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Up next, we go to Rhode Island, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app, is Giovanni in Rhode Island. Giovanni, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Can you hear me?
We can, yeah.
I read your book, How to Be Catholic. It was a good book. However, it didn't cover, Divine Simplicity. So you have two small questions on that. Question one would be, how can God's power be, his intellect, or how can he be his action? Second would be, doesn't the Trinity disprove, divine simplicity in any way?
Those are not small questions, Giovanni. Like, two small questions is like, name the persons of the Trinity. That would be like one. Like, how do you explain divine simplicity? I think these are great questions, but they are not small questions. Can you answer them, Trent, or are they too hard?
Well, there are going to be nuances to the question we won't be able to get into in the short time that we have here, but I will take my best crack at it. So divine simplicity is the doctrine, and it is a dogma of the faith. It's been enumerated at ecumenical councils, that God is not composed of parts, either physical or even metaphysical. The idea that what God is, God just is the infinite act of being itself. God just is. God's essence, what he is, just is existence, that he is. That's what he says to Moses in Exodus 3:14. He tells Moses, I am that I am. I am that I am. That's my name. You know, so
it's not Popeye.
Well, actually, I was that. Anywho, okay. I won't go into all the references that I'm making here. But I am that I am. That's he did not speak in a Popeye voice. So the idea here is that God is not made of parts. And why is that important? Well, if you think about it, if something is made of parts, what is the difference between a part and a whole? What makes something composed of parts? If something is composed of parts, it means there's something more basic than that thing that holds them together. I mean, I'm drinking a little drink here. It's composed of parts, the lid and the atoms that make up the cup. And so there's forces that keep all of this together. But even if it's not material parts, if there are different parts of God, there's something prior to God, more basic, fundamental than him, that puts them all together. But then you got a problem, because if God is composed of parts, if God is, like, we're always trying to find what's the most fundamental part of reality, what's the basement? You can't go beyond that. Like, this is just the ultimate foundation of reality. If it's a God with parts, then beyond that would be something that unites God's parts together. And whatever that is, whatever that thing is that keeps all of God's parts together, united into his divine being, that thing would be God, because it's what makes God God. So a God that is composed of parts, David Bentley Hart, who is an Eastern Orthodox theologian and philosopher, he has said that denying divine simplicity is tantamount to atheism, because a God made of parts is really more of a God with a lowercase g, not an uppercase g. But then, of course, this is a doctrine that was, of course, it was very popular in the Middle Ages, basically. But in modern times, modern philosophers of religion, including many Christians, are skeptical of it. And so we have two, Giovanni has raised two issues here. One is, if God is not composed of parts, then it seems like all of his properties are identical. So it's not like God has a separate part of him that is his property of being omnipotence, or his property of omniscience, that they would all be the same thing. So modern philosophers talk about things having properties. But if, you know, Cy Kellett is so over many feet tall and he wears a light blue shirt, that'd be an accidental property more. But, okay, so then what do we do if God has no parts? All of these parts must be the same thing. I think the objection misunderstands divine simplicity when people say, no, I understand where the objection comes from, because when you go to the catechism, it says this in the catechism in paragraph 271. God's almighty power is in no way arbitrary. Then I believe it quotes Aquinas, who says, in God, power, essence, will, intellect, wisdom, and justice are all identical. Nothing, therefore, can be in God's power which could not be in his just will or his wise intellect. So while some people think this is a liability, like, oh, that's confusing. Power isn't intellect. They're totally different. How can God's power just be his intellect? Well, first, there is a virtue here, because some people say, look, how can you say God is good? Like, if he's super powerful, what if he just said, okay, I'm God. Evil's going to be good today because I said so. That's called the Euthyphro dilemma in philosophy. But God, he couldn't do that. He couldn't say evil is good today because I felt like it. So the catechism is saying, well, no, God's power isn't arbitrary, that his intellect, his perfect intellect and his power are the same thing. So he's never going to do something evil because his power and his abilities aren't arbitrary. Now, I think where people get off the track here is they think that when we say God has the property of omnipotence, or being able to do anything, or the property of omniscience, or knowing everything, we think of properties like they're like ornaments on a Christmas tree. Like, I'm going to hang omnipotence, and here's omniscience, and they're all on God. Well, wait, these two ornaments can't be the same ornament. But we're always speaking about God in analogy. So when we say God has the property of omnipotence, we don't mean it's a metaphysical part of God that tells him what he will and he won't do. It's just a way of saying that God, the infinite act of being, is not limited in what he does, and God is not limited in what he knows. And so they don't contradict one another. So that would be my first answer there on that. It's just different ways of describing the unlimited act of being, not separate, distinct parts of God. The Trinity is a bit harder of one, because we say, well, if God is the infinite act of being, what do we do if God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? If God is simple, no parts, we got one part's the Father, one part's the Son, one part's the Holy Spirit. What do you do with that? And the answer I would say is that the Father and the Holy Spirit do not divide God's being. They don't divide his being because God is infinite being, and the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit all infinitely possess the divine being. Rather, these are distinctions that exist in a relational way in God. So the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit only differ from one another in the divine essence in their relationships to each other, but they all fully express the one undivided divine being. So there's more we could certainly go into, and I don't want to bog everybody down, but I will give, there are some resources I would recommend for people. One would be the Classical Theism podcast. My friend John DeRosa does a wonderful podcast, the Classical Theism podcast. He has episodes on divine simplicity there. There's also a book on the subject. I believe it's by James Dolezal called God Without Parts. That I'd recommend as a he's actually a non-Catholic. I believe he's not Catholic, but he writes about this. It's a defense of divine simplicity. So I hope that is helpful. And Giovanni, I'm glad you called in.
Thanks, Giovanni. Lines are full. Got to keep moving. Kai in New York watching on YouTube. You are next. Kai, go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Kellett and Mr. Horn, for taking my question.
Happy to.
Sure.
So I also saw your debate with Mr. Dilahunty, and you actually gave me a lot to think about. And I think you did a great job, but that's not what my question is about. My question is
sure.
about
well, thank you, though.
For yes, of course. So for people who are coming in to the Catholic Church, why is it that you have to go through the RCIA and then get baptized once Easter comes, instead of if the way I think about it is that if the Catholic Church here is dealing with the salvation of human souls, why does it wait potentially a year until someone gets baptized instead of saying, you believe in Jesus Christ, he's the Son of God, we're going to baptize you, and then after that we'll teach you all about the faith and all of these things, and we'll teach you about the church and the history and these and all things that go along with it. If you can
sure.
answer, obviously I think the symbolism of getting baptized on Easter is beautiful, but I'm not sure necessarily why it has to be that way.
Sure. So when we, it's interesting, if you think that question yourself, like when a baby is baptized, we baptize them as soon as possible. There was even a controversy in the early church around Tertullian's time in the 3rd century when people thought that it was the most appropriate to baptize a baby on the 8th day after they were born, because that's when they were circumcised in the Old Covenant. And as Colossians chapter 2 says, that baptism replaces circumcision in the Old Covenant. That is the new sign of the New Covenant, so it replaces it. So they thought, oh, we'll wait 8 days like we did in the Old. And the church fathers at the time said, no, don't baptize a child as soon as you can, because at that time, infant mortality was incredibly high. In the ancient world, child mortality was very high. Probably in most places, it was about 50%. That meant that a child, half of all children in the ancient world, really up until through the Middle Ages, honestly, not until about the late 19th and early 20th centuries, no, not until like getting into the 20th century do you get down. You still have child mortality rates up around 20 or 30%. But in the ancient times, half of all children didn't make it to their 5th birthday. Half did not make it. Usually died of some kind of gastrointestinal disease or pneumonia or something like that. And so newborn babies are very, very frail in an ancient world without medicine and good nutrients and things like that. They were just baptized as soon as they could after birth. And also because the baptism of a baby, the reception of baptism is predicated upon the faith of the parents. As long as the parents show faith and a desire to raise the child needs nothing. But adults are different in two respects there. Number one, even at that time in the ancient world, if you made it past the age of 5, adults could actually live a fairly long time. Even in ancient Rome, some people have this mistake. They think, oh, in the ancient world, nobody, if you were 40, you were like an old man. That's actually not true. Because the life expectancy, people thought like, oh, it's only at 40. But that's because the high child mortality throws it off. In ancient Rome, there were rules. You could retire from the Senate or jury duty when you turn 65, for example. So there's time. And the same is true today, that most adults in the modern world today, they're not at risk of dying just unexpectedly, all things being equal. And then number two, the difference here is that when a baby's baptized, it's predicated on the faith of the parents. When an adult is baptized, it is upon their own faith, and you have to, the Catholic faith is just something that cannot be summarized in a simple sentence. It's not like getting saved. You believe in Jesus, you're saved. No, we're affirming a lot more about the Church of Christ that we are now going to be baptized into. Baptism is not just about getting saved. It's about being in full communion with Christ's church. And to do that, we have to understand what the church teaches, which is why we have preparation period for adults. But I'd love to put a bow on the question when we come back from the break.
Hang on, Kai. We'll do that. Trent Horn is our guest. It's Open Forum. 888-318-7884 is our number.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
According to divine command, we should give God worship, but how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help? To make me feel better? A form of social activism or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship. God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We all take on traits from our parents.
What are the best and worst traits you received from your parents?
We'll discuss that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Second hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here with us this hour. Trent Horn is our guest, and Trent is in the middle of a conversation with Kai in New York, who's watching on YouTube, and asked the basic question, why do Catholics make you wait to take some classes? And I mean, it's not necessarily classes, but to do some formation and get some instruction before you can be baptized. Why do we do this? And you wanted to conclude your answer, Trent.
Yeah, so basically, just to quickly re-summarize, babies throughout church history, because they're at risk of high mortality and because they do not need instruction, were baptized as soon as possible after birth. Adults, however, they have to make an assent of faith, so they have to assent to the faith and its major teachings. And so in choosing to become Catholic, we are being incorporated. We are saying yes, not just to Christ, but to the church he established and the things that it desires for us to profess and to hold. And so that requires instruction that takes place over a certain amount of time. Now, Kai said, yeah, but if we, why can't, you know, you could say, why can't it just be a month? You know, does it have to, you know, what if, what it's symbolic to come in on Easter, obviously, it's a traditional date to receive, to baptize people. But what if somebody dies and we're risking their salvation for a symbolic goal? And what I would say is that the church has recognized long throughout its history that salvation is, as Catechism says in paragraph 1257, God has bound salvation to the sacrament of baptism, but he is not bound by the sacraments. He can save people any way he wants. And throughout church history, there have been two long recognized exceptions to salvation by water baptism. One would be baptism by blood. If you die, even if you're not baptized, if you confessed the faith as a martyr for the faith, you were considered to be saved. And then baptism of desire, that someone who explicitly desires baptism and is the process of being formed for it, they die before that because they explicitly desire the grace of baptism. It's been traditionally taught that God would apply those graces to the person who is deprived of baptism through no fault of their own. In fact, throughout church history, catechumens, those who have formally entered the process of being received into the church, if they died prior to baptism, were still buried in holy ground because there was such confidence for their salvation. So now, however, there could be unusual circumstances where someone is gravely ill or has some other unusual circumstance that they would want to be baptized at a different time. That's something they can sort out with their pastor or with the bishop. But as a general rule, it is not a hindrance to anyone's salvation, certainly.
Kai, thanks. I hope that was a helpful answer to your question. We're going to go to Utah now. Bryce in Utah, watching on Facebook Live. You are next, Bryce. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. And Cy, thank you. Thanks a lot to you, because I was baptized this Easter Sunday. And what played a large role in that was listening to Catholic Answers Focus.
Oh.
The episodes with you and Father Hugh Barber. They were fantastic. You should do more episodes with him. He's great.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you so much for all you guys do.
Thank you, Bryce. And thank you for sharing that. It's very, very moving. And thank you very much for sharing that.
Yeah. And so, Trent, my question for you today is on accidental versus essential properties. So do human beings have unique individual essential properties, or do we just have human essential properties? And what makes us unique is accidental properties. And then if we do have unique essential properties, could those be the basis for free will to reconcile it with divine knowledge?
It's kind of a baby question, but I'm willing to
it's kind of a beginner entry level there, Bryce, but okay.
Yeah. I might need to ask some clarifying questions to break down what you mean by that. So the typical distinction in philosophy between an essential and an accidental property is that an accidental property is something that can be removed or altered, and the identity of the subject in question does not change. Whereas an accidental property, a thing can still be that thing even if it loses an accidental property. But an essential property is something where a thing cannot be that thing if it loses that essential property. Oh man, I haven't done this. This will be fun. So the fact that Cy has facial hair, that would be an accidental property to being Cy Kellett. If Cy Kellett lost his facial hair, he would still be Cy Kellett. That's an accidental property to what it means to be Cy Kellett. But if Cy Kellett were to lose his head, with the state of medical technology as it is right now, if we were to remove Cy Kellett's head, the person Cy Kellett, the human being Cy Kellett, would no longer exist, because having a head attached to a body with a functioning circulatory and respiratory system is an essential property for being the human being Cy Kellett. So look at that, Cy. We didn't even have to do a Why Are You Pro-Choice show. Someone put a tally on the board.
Yeah,
a tally.
You managed to kill me on an open forum. Congratulations!
I managed to do that. This is a humor to our listeners. Whenever I do thought experiments, sometimes Psy meets a grisly end, and I haven't done that in a while. So now we can do that. So, Bryce, your question is: are there certain essential and accidental properties when it comes to human beings that might be a basis of our free will? Well, what I'd say for human beings, that one of the essential properties of being a human being is to have a rational nature. So you can't be a human being if you do not have a nature that is ordered towards making rational, free decisions. You don't have to have the current ability to do that. That can be impeded by lack of development or injury or disability, but you have to be naturally ordered towards that end. I think that's essential to being a human being. But the certain free decisions you make or don't make, those might, I would call them accidental properties. But yeah, I don't know if I might need more from you to make sure I'm breaking it down right. Help me out here, I guess. Or am I, so am I taking off the plane okay?
So I guess what I would wonder is that are me and Cy Kellett essentially different? Like, I'm a creature with an essentially different will, and he is? Or is all the differences between me and Cy just accidental?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say that it would be impossible for you to be Cy Kellett or vice versa. I mean, there are accidental changes where there are roles that can be assumed by more than one person. So, I mean, we can have more than one Catholic apologist at Catholic Answers if they have certain accidental and essential properties. But an essential another essential property of being Cy Kellett is having the soul that God created for the body of Cy Kellett. We are a composite of body and soul. So one of the essential properties, like if you're Cy Kellett, then some essential properties would be you have to be a human organism. If you're not a human organism, you are not Cy Kellett. You could be a fancy robot. You could be like Vision from the MCU. Maybe we'll get one of those in Catholic Answers one of these days. But you would not be Cy Kellett if you're not a human organism. I don't care who or what you are. You also have to have Cy Kellett's soul. If you don't have his soul, that's an essential property for being Cy, to have that unique, irreplaceable soul. That is essential. You could develop hosting abilities on par with or possibly surpassing Cy. That would be an accidental property. But it wouldn't make you Cy Kellett if you were the host of Catholic Answers Live. That's something that can change. So I would say your soul, the deep element of who you are as a person, that is an essential property you share alone that cannot be communicated to other people. And I think that would have a lot of consequences for human identity and possibly for our own freedom, our will, and our ability to act in a unique and distinctly human way. So I hope that's helpful, and I'm very glad you called in. Thank you.
Thanks, Bryce. I guess we got to go to a quick break. It's been a long time, Trent. It's been a long time. I've survived many shows with you and didn't make it out of this one alive.
This sounds like we're in some kind of like a Western or something, and I just brought out the hypothetical where you die, and you just look at me and you'd say, "It's been a long time." That has to be it's got to be gritty in that way. It has to be really gritty.
Little more Clint Eastwood. I needed a little more Clint Eastwood in my voice. Interesting that you said someday maybe we'll get an apologist like Vision. Have you not met Jimmy Akin? Have you never met Jimmy Akin? I think it's possible that he is an advanced computer of some sort.
Some kind of in the MCU, I think they call them like sapioids. They don't call them humanoids or androids. They call them something else, but. You never know. You'll have to ask Jimmy next time he's on.
Thanks again for the question. We got to take a quick break. Here with us is the director of development here at Catholic Answers, Dave Matheson. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good, Cy. How are you?
I am very, very well. And you started on 3/15, on March 15th, you started this new society called Society 3/15.
We did.
Kind of a way for people who are really interested in apologetics to get all kinds of benefits from being part of this group. You're almost a month in. How's it going?
It's going great, and I appreciate you having me on today. It's indeed, Cy, this is a group that is designed for monthly, online, givers to Catholic Answers. You can be a member for as little as $10 a month. If you break that down, that's about 33 cents a day, right? So it's accessible to any donor, anybody that wants to be a part of what we do and partner with us in our apologetics and evangelization efforts. And in return for that membership, you get some great stuff. You get a t-shirt, you get a magnet, you get a great welcome box, and you get a discount for any Catholic Answers product on our shop. But even more than that, you become a part of a community. Become a part of a community of folks that are particularly interested in apologetics, evangelization, and what we will deliver to you is exclusive talks, exclusive ebooks, podcasts, webinars, all sorts of things like that. In fact, if you join today, you will be able to get video of our staff retreat, which is happening tomorrow. All day tomorrow, we're going to be at our staff retreat.
With Father Dave McConey, one of the great retreat leaders.
Father Dave McConey of St. Louis University. We are really excited to have him. But if and only if you are a member of Society 315, you can go on retreat with us, and we will be sending you video of Father McConey's talks from the Catholic Answer staff retreat taking place tomorrow.
If I ask questions, can I be on the video if I ask questions?
Well, you might hear you in the background. It's going to be, Father McConey's going to be front and center, so we really want you to feel like you are indeed on retreat with us when you get those videos. But it's, again, this is member-exclusive stuff. You're only going to get it if you're a member of Society 315.
CASociety315.com is where you go to sign up. CASociety315.com. David says 33 cents a day. I say 2 sandwiches a month. That's my way of thinking about it.
Hey, and you can join for more than that, certainly.
Cost you two sandwiches a month.
Yeah, let me add two real quick things, Si. One, if you are already a monthly donor to Catholic Answers, giving $10 or more per month, you too can add club benefits to your existing donation. All you have to do is email society315, mm-hmm. society315@catholic.com. society315@catholic.com. Say, hey, I'm an existing donor. I want to be a member of the club. And if you have already joined Society 315, those welcome kits, which you guys have been waiting for now, some of you for, gosh, almost 6 weeks now, they are going out in the mail this week.
Join. 2 sandwiches a month. CA Society 315. And tomorrow I am going to run behind Father McConey and wave at some point. I'm doing it. I've decided.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn, our guest. It's open forum. And if we get to the top of the hour and we haven't gotten to your question, don't worry. Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here with us second hour. We're going to continue open forum. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Trent is proprietor of The Council of Trent. This is a very popular podcast. This has become very – well, I don't know why I have surprise in my voice, but this is – I'm just going to say it with that. This is a very popular podcast, Trent Horn's podcast. You can get it at TrentHornPodcast.com. I know. I don't know why. I hate when I do that. Like, I am shocked at your success, Trent Horn. Totally surprised. What's on this week?
Well, this week, today, I just aired an episode, an interview with Jimmy Akin called What's Wrong with Apologetics? And so nothing.
Did my name come up? Because I hope not.
No, it's actually a lengthier episode, but Jimmy and I had a great talk about where apologetics, really where it loses its way when it's applied improperly.
Oh, okay.
So, and then we talk about how to fix that, how to make it better, and very wonderful show. Always great to have Jimmy on. Then Thursday, I'll give a sneak peek for Thursday's episode. Thursday, I'm going to be, I'll be sharing a talk that I gave at for a cohort of sex and gender studies classes where I presented the Catholic view on sexuality for these sex and gender studies students.
Good for you, Trent Horn. That is great.
I'll tell you what's even funnier about it, Si. I'm not going to say where it was at, but it was a talk I gave for a major Catholic university. But they decided it'd be best to bring in an outside person to give the Catholic perspective.
Did you feel that they were receptive?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think they were very receptive. And so I think the talk was – I focused specifically – I gave the talk with a partner. My partner spoke on the issue of homosexuality. I spoke on gender identity. So in this podcast episode, I'm going to share the talk I gave on the church's teaching on transgender, gender identity, that I and how I crafted it for these university students, who even if they go to a Catholic university, I suspect the majority of them do not affirm the church's teaching on this subject. So I offered them the teaching and good reasons for it. And that'll be on Thursday's episode. And yeah, if you guys want great access to content like my catechism study series, which is going on now, the Council of Trent mug, lots of other cool stuff, the ability to submit questions for our open mailbag episodes, go to trenthornpodcast.com to become a subscriber there.
Trenthornpodcast.com. Now we go to Ontario, Canada. Remember yesterday? It's on. It's
Ontario.
Says,
you mean Ontario, Florida?
No, it's Ontario, Canada today.
You said yesterday it was right south of Temple Pines.
It is. Ontario, Florida is just south of Temple Pines, Florida. But this is Jason in Ontario, Canada. He's been waiting patiently. Jason, thank you for waiting patiently. I'm sorry that I made you wait patiently. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Trent Horn.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This is this first long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, we're
thank
very
you so
happy
much
to
for
have
that you. Guys do.
Well, thank you. You don't have a Canadian accent, though.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that's true.
And no judgment.
How can we help you, Jason?
Go ahead.
You should be sorry about that.
I have a question. I'm a Catholic, and I've actually followed Trent's podcast. It's amazing. Thank you so much for doing that. I have all your books, The Case for Catholicism and Hard Sayings, both, and I do reference them all the time whenever I can. So my question is actually, I've been looking online, and there's an Islamic apologist who has been bringing up things against the Bible. And he kind of debunks or says a lot of things against the Gospel of John and all the other Gospels, and he just looks at Mark. And then he brings up, according to him, one of the most embarrassing verses in the Bible, according to him, and that is Mark chapter 13, verse 30. And it says, "Amen, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place." And according to him, because Christ was talking about the end times and this generation will not pass away, he kind of attacks Jesus' divinity there. So I wanted to get Trent's take on this and how to reply to that.
Yeah, and I think what's important to keep in mind here, so in Mark 13:30, some might say, well, Jesus, and this is similar to Matthew 24, people will bring this up, when it says, truly all these things... This generation will not pass away before all these things take place. What are the things that are taking place that he is referring to this generation? So I guess you can ask, what is this generation and what are all these things? Some people may argue that this generation is a generation of believers in general. That could extend until the end of time, though that's, I think, a far weaker interpretation, but one that's out there. The other one, though, I think would be to focus on the all these things and what Jesus is specifically referring to. If he's saying that those who are the generation at that time when he's preaching around the year 30, 31, what is he talking about? Because he's talking about destruction that's going to take place. Go back to the beginning of Mark chapter 13. It's very clear that while Jesus is alluding to cosmic destruction and the end of the world, he's also talking about the end of a world or the end of Judaism as it had been known up until that time, which would involve the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. We know that because go to the beginning of the chapter at Mark 13. It sets the tone for it. As he came out of the temple, and I love it, as he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And to understand, these are a bunch of fishermen from Galilee. So it'd be like taking your rural cousins to New York City for the first time. It's like, gee whiz, look at these tall buildings here. Yeah, but that's like, they even would have had a kind of a country bumpkin accent when they said it. Because remember, Peter was identified as a Galilean by his accent. So I just imagine, Si, when this Mark 13, what wonderful, gee whiz, Jesus, look at these tall buildings here. We just, you got nothing like this back home. And so then Jesus saying, do you see what's going to happen?
Wait, my rural cousins are not Gomer Pyle, all right? I have perfectly intelligent rural cousins. I'm throwing that out there. I'm trying to...
I never dissuaded their intelligence. A person can say, gee whiz, look at these big buildings here.
I go, oh, they just,
Golly. So then he continues to say, there'll be one stone left upon another that won't be thrown down. Now, you might say, okay, he's talking about the destruction of the temple. But then you go further in like verse 24, he talks about the stars falling from heaven, the powers of heaven being shaken. How could he he's talking about the universe now, not about the temple. Well, no, because for Jews, Second Temple Jews, the temple in Jerusalem, it was not just another building. It was the dwelling place of God. It was a microcosm, or like a little mini universe in and of itself. Like the temple was God's dwelling place on earth. It was almost like a shrunken universe there for people to go and worship God in. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that they're embroidered on the temple curtains were stars and the planets and celestial bodies were put on the walls of the temple. And so when the temple was destroyed and these walls collapse after the Roman invasion and destruction of the temple in July, August of the year 70, literally the stars would have been falling if the temple was set on fire and then collapsed and was destroyed. And so I think that's the best way to read this in Mark 13:30 and also Matthew 24, when Jesus is talking about the destruction and how people in this time will wait to within this generation. It did happen within that generation. It happened 40 years later with the destruction of the temple. And I think that emphasizes and really shows clearly what Jesus is talking about for his immediate audience, while still having elements of for a future cataclysm that would encompass the whole world with the second coming. The idea that he kind of comes in a second coming, if you will, in the visitation upon Jerusalem. Like in the Old Testament, God was said to visit to kingdoms that were destroyed. Jesus visits the city, in a sense, through the Roman armies that destroy it, as he prophesied. But then there's the ultimate cataclysm and tribulation at the second coming. But I talk about all of this in my book, Counterfeit Christ. So, Jason, I think what we can do is we'll get your email address and we will avoid Canadian shipping charges. I'd like to email you my book, Counterfeit Christ. It has a whole chapter on whether Jesus was a failed prophet or not, that, and other stuff in there for your Muslim friends. There's a whole chapter on the Muslim view of Jesus, because if that is their complaint about the Bible, what do you do about something like in the Quran in Surah 4:157, which contradicts one of the most established facts in the ancient world, that Jesus was crucified, which the Quran says didn't happen? So we'll send you Counterfeit Christ, and I hope that is helpful in your discussion with your Muslim friends.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks very much. I think we have time for another quick question. Let's go to Ian, also in Canada, watching on YouTube. Ian, you got to be fast. Can you ask your question quickly?
Yes, I can. Thank you for taking my call today. So my question is, I've heard that in about like more thousands of years ago in hunter-gatherer societies, the concept of marriage like did not exist, and then marriage only came to be when the agricultural revolution started, and that, you know, it was a way to guard wealth and pass it down generations. So my question is when did marriage become a moral issue rather than a societal agreement?
Sure. Let me jump in on that. So I would say that view of marriage is false. That marriage is something that is not created by the state. Marriage is something that God created and wrote into human nature. That even in hunter-gatherer societies, you still had marriage, maybe also polygamy, but you still had monogamous marriage, because marriage existed there not so much to pass on property, but to say, all right, this is the person who can have sexual relations with this woman, and if this woman bears any children, this is the person that provides for this woman and those children. And so there were very few men in a hunter-gatherer society that could amass enough resources to have multiple wives. So you still had marriage there as something that human nature recognizes, that since sex makes babies, you need something that unites men and women to one another to know they are with each other, and any children that proceed from their union belong to them until they come to an age of reason or to an age of adulthood. So marriage is something written on human nature, and that's something recognized in virtually all cultures. A good book on this is The Future of Marriage by David Blankenhorn. That covers a lot of the sociology and prehistory. And we also have other resources on marriage on our website at Catholic.com.
And that'll do it for Trent Horn. Thanks, Trent. Hey, if you're on the line, stay on the line. Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here in just a moment to take your calls. Trent Horn has been our guest, apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of many books, and you can find that podcast, Council of Trent, over at Trent hornpodcast.com. Thanks, Trent.
Thank you for having me.
That's three fun hours I've had with you already this week. Thank you for helping me through my first
Can't
part of my week.
Back on again. Absolutely.
All right. More Open Forum with Father Paul Jerome Keller on Catholic Answers Live right after this.